obviously, whenever the boy was present. With nobody else around, he would grow up thinking that talking and signing were really no different from each other. You did all this? Well, I had help. Show me the rest. He led her inside. There were two rooms on the main floor, with real glass windows and a kitchen with a stove and a pump, and a flight of stairs that led to a loft where the three of them would sleep. The floor, of sawn oak planks, felt solid underfoot. It'll be too hot to sleep inside in the summer, but I can build a sleeping porch out back. Pim was smiling. She looked as if she couldn't believe her eyes. When will you have time for that? I'll do it, don't worry. They unloaded a night's worth of gear. In a few days, Caleb would have to return to town, an 8-mile ride to begin the process of securing stock. A milk cow, a goat or two, chickens. His seeds were ready to plant. The soil had been turned. They would be growing corn and beans in alternating rows, with a kitchen garden out back. The first year would be a race against time. After that, he hoped, things would settle into a more predictable rhythm, though life would never be easy by any means. They ate a simple dinner and lay down on the mattress he had moved inside from the wagon to the floor of the main room. He'd wondered if Pim would be afraid or at least anxious being out here, just the three of them. She'd never spent a night beyond the city walls. But the opposite seemed true. She appeared completely at ease, eager to see how their situation unfolded. Of course, there was a reason. The things that had happened to her when she was a young girl had become for her a source of strength. Pim had crept up on his life slowly. At the beginning, when Sarah had brought her home from the orphanage, she had hardly seemed like a person to him. Her blunt gestures and guttural groans unnerved him. Extending even the simplest kindness was met with incomprehension, even anger. The situation had started to change when Sarah taught Pim sign language. They moved through this improvisationally, beginning by spelling out every word, then advancing to whole phrases and ideas that could be captured with a single swoop of the hand. A book from the library had been involved, but later, when Kate gave it to Caleb to study, he realized that many of the gestures Pim used were made up, a bubble of private language that only she and her mother, and to a degree, Kate and her father, shared. Caleb was, by this point, 14 or 15. He was a clever boy, unused to problems he could not solve. Also, Pim had begun to seem interesting to him. What sort of person was she? The fact that he could not communicate with her as he could with everybody else was both frustrating and attractive. He made a point of carefully observing Pim's interactions with members of her family to encode these gestures into memory. Alone in his room, he practiced in front of a mirror for hours, signing both sides of dialogues on arbitrary topics. How are you today? I am very well, thank you. What do you think of the weather? I enjoy the rain, but I'm looking forward to warmer days. It became important that he delay the unveiling of his new abilities until he had acquired the confidence to engage her on a range of subjects. The opportunity presented itself on an afternoon outing their families had taken together to the spillway. While everyone else was enjoying their picnic by the water, he had climbed to the top of the dam. There, he saw Pim sitting on the concrete, writing in her journal. She was always writing. Caleb had wondered about this. She glanced up as he made his approach, her dark eyes narrowing on him in their intense way, then looked away dismissively. Her brown hair, long and glossy and tucked behind her ears, flared with captured sunshine. He stood for a moment observing her. She was 3 years older than he was, basically an adult in his eyes. She had also become very pretty, though in a no-nonsense way that came across as condescending, even a little icy. His presence was obviously unwelcome, but it was too late to back out. Caleb walked up to her. She regarded him with her head slightly cocked to the side, wearing an expression of bored mirth. "Hello," he signed. She closed her book around her pencil. "You want to kiss me, don't you?" The question was so unexpectedly direct that he actually startled. Did he? Was that what this was all about? Now she really was laughing at him, laughing with her eyes. "I know you know what I'm saying," she sighed. He found the answer with his hands. "I learned. From me or for yourself?" He felt caught. "Both." "Have you kissed anyone before?" He hadn't. It was something he had been meaning to get around to. He knew he was blushing. "A few times?" "No, you haven't. Hands don't lie." He recognized the truth of this. All his study and practice, yet he'd failed to notice the obvious fact, which Pym had laid bare to him in mere seconds. Signing was a language of complete forthrightness. Within its compact rhetoric, little space remained for evasion, for the self-protecting half-truths that were most of what people said to one another. "Do you want to?" She stood and faced him. "Okay." So they did. He closed his eyes, thinking this was something he should do, tilted his head slightly, and leaned forward. Their noses bumped, then passed each other, their lips meeting in a soft collision. It was over before he knew it. "Did you like it?" He barely believed this was actually happening. He spelled out his answer. "Lots." "Open your mouth this time." That was even better. A soft pressure entered his mouth that he realized was her tongue. He followed her lead. Now they were kissing for real. He had always imagined the act to be a simple grazing of surfaces, lips upon lips. But kissing was, he now understood, far more complex. It was more a mingling than a touching. They did this for a while, exploring one another's mouths. Then she backed away in a manner that indicated that the kissing was over. Caleb wished it weren't. He could have done it for a long while more. Then he understood the nature of the interruption. Sarah was calling to them from the bottom of the dam. Pym smiled at him. "You're a good kisser." And that was all, at least for a time. In due course, they had kissed again, and done different things as well, but it hadn't amounted to much, and other girls had come along. Yet always those slender minutes on the dam remained in his mind as a singular point in his life. When he joined the army at 18, his CO said he should find someone back home to write to. He chose Pym. His letters were all cheerful nonsense, complaints about the food and light-hearted stories of his friends. But hers were unlike anything he'd ever read, richly observant and full of life. At times, they read like poetry. A single phrase, even describing something trivial, how the sun looked on leaves, a passing remark by an acquaintance, the smell of cooking food, would catch his mind and linger for days. Unlike sign language, with its unequivocal compactness, Pym's words on the page seemed to overflow with feeling. A richer kind of truth, closer to the heart of her. He wrote to Pym as often as he could, hungering for more of her. It was her voice he was hearing, hearing at last, and it wasn't long before he began to fall in love with her. When he told her, not in a letter but in person when he returned to Kerrville on a 3-day pass, she laughed with her eyes, then signed, "When did you finally figure it out?" To these memories, Caleb drifted into sleep. Sometime later, he awoke to find her gone. He didn't worry. Pym was something of a night owl. Theo was still asleep. Caleb slid into his trousers, lit the lantern, got his rifle from its place by the door, and stepped outside. Pim was sitting with her back against the stump he used for splitting. "Everything okay?"
"Douse the light," she signed. "Come sit."
She was wearing only her nightgown, though it was actually quite chilly. Her feet were bare. He took his place beside her and extinguished the lantern. In the dark, they had a system. She took his hand and in his palm signed in miniature,
"Look."
"At what?"
"Everything."
He understood what she was saying between the lines.
"This is ours." "I like it here."
"I'm glad." Caleb detected movement in the brush. The sound came again, a grassy rustling to their left. Not a raccoon or possum.
Something larger.
Pim sensed his sudden alertness.
"What?"
"Wait." He relit the lantern, casting a pool of light on the ground. The rustling was coming from several places now, though generally in the same direction. He positioned the rifle under his arm and clenched it to his side with his elbow. Holding the lantern in one hand, the rifle in the other, he crept forward toward the heart of the sounds. The light caught something. A flash of eyes. It was a young deer. It froze in the light, staring at him. He saw the others, six in all. For a moment, nothing moved. Man and deer regarding one another with mutual astonishment. Then, as if guided by a common mind, the herd turned as one and burst away. What could he do? What else could Caleb Jackson do but laugh? 26. "Okay, Rand, try it now." Michael was lying on his back, wedged into the slender gap between the floor and the base of the compressor. He heard the valve opening. Gas began to move through the line.
"What's it say?"
"Looks like it's holding."
"Don't you dare leak," Michael thought. "I've given you half my morning."
"Nope. Pressure's dropping."
God damn it.
He'd checked every seal he could think of. Where the hell was the gas coming from?
The hell with it. Shut it off.
Michael wriggled free. They were on the lower engineering level. From the catwalk above came the sounds of metal striking metal, the crackling hiss of arc welders, men calling to one another, all of it amplified by the acoustics of the engine compartment. Michael hadn't seen sunshine for 48 hours.
"Any ideas?" he asked Rand.
The man was standing with his hands in the pockets of his trousers. There was something equine about him. He had small eyes, delicate seeming in his strong face, and black wavy hair that, despite his age, somewhere north of 45, failed to show more than scattered threads of gray. Calm, reliable Rand. He had never spoken of a wife or girlfriend. He never visited Dunk's Whores. Michael had never pressed, the matter being one of supreme unimportance.
"It could be someplace in the charger," Rand suggested. "Tight fit, though."
Michael looked up at the catwalk and yelled, to whomever might hear him, "Where's Patch?" Patch's real name was Byron Szymanski. The nickname came from the anomalous square of white in his otherwise coal-black stubble. Like many of Michael's men, he had been raised in the orphanage. He'd done a stint in the military, learning a thing or two about engines along the way, then worked for the civilian authority as a mechanic. He had no relatives, had never married, and professed no desire to do so, possessed no bad habits Michael knew of, didn't mind the isolation, wasn't a talker, took orders without complaint, and liked to work. Perfect, in other words, for Michael's purposes. A wiry 5'3", he spent whole days in pockets of the ship so cramped that another man wouldn't have been able to draw a breath. Michael paid him accordingly, though nobody could complain about the wages. Every cent Michael made from the stills went straight to the Bergensfjord. A face appeared above. Weir's. He drew his welder's mask up to his forehead.
I think he's on the bridge. Send somebody to get him.
As Michael bent for his tool bag, Rand rapped him on the arm.
We've got company.
Michael looked up. Dunk was coming down the stairs. Michael needed the man, just as Dunk needed him. But their relationship was not an easy one. Needless to say, Dunk knew nothing of Michael's true purpose. He regarded the Bergensfjord as an eccentric distraction, an elaborate pastime on which Michael wasted his time. Time better spent putting more money in Dunk's pockets. That the man had never bothered to wonder just why Michael needed to refloat a 600-foot freighter was just more evidence of his limited intelligence.
Great, Michael said. You want me to get some guys together? He looks pissed.
How can you tell? Rand moved away. At the base of the stairs, Dunk halted, propped his hands on his hips, and surveyed the room with an expression of weary irritation. The tattoos on his face ended abruptly at his former hairline. A lifetime of hard living had done him few favors in the aging department, but he was still built like a tank. For entertainment, he liked to lift a truck by its bumper.
What can I do for you, Dunk?
He had a way of smiling that made Michael think of a cork in a bottle.
I really should get down here more often. I don't know what half this stuff is. Take those things over there.
He wagged a meaty finger, thick as a sausage. Water jacket pumps.
What do they do?
The day was getting away without much to show for it. Now he had to deal with this. It's kind of technical. Not really your thing.
Why am I here, Michael?
Guessing games, as if they were 5 years old. A sudden interest in marine repair? Dunk's eyes hardened on Michael's face.
I'm here, Michael, because you're not meeting your obligation to me. Mystic's open for settlement. That means demand. I need the new boiler up and running. Not later, today.
Michael aimed his voice at the catwalk.
Has anybody found Patch yet? We're looking.
He turned toward Dunk again. What an ox the man was. He should have been strapped to a plow.
I'm kind of busy at the moment. Allow me to remind you of the terms. You do your magic with the stills, I give you 10% of the profits. It's not hard to remember.
Michael yelled up to the catwalk again.
Sometime today would be nice.
The next thing Michael knew, he was rammed up against the bulkhead, Dunk's forearm pressing against his throat.
Do I have your attention now?
The man's broad, pitted nose was inches from Michael's. His breath was sour as old wine.
Easy, amigo. We don't have to do this in front of the kids. You work for me, goddammit. If I could point something out, breaking my neck might feel good in the moment, but it won't get you any more lick.
Everything okay, Michael?
Rand was standing behind Dunk with two others, Fastow and Weir. Rand was clutching a long wrench. The other two had lengths of pipe. They were holding these implements in an offhand manner, as if they'd merely picked them up in the course of a day's work.
Just a little misunderstanding, Michael replied. How about it, Dunk? We don't need to have a problem here. You've got my attention, I promise.
Dunk's arm pressed tighter against his throat.
Fuck you.
Michael glanced over Dunk's shoulder at Weir and Fastow.
You two, go check on the stills. See what the situation is, then report back to me. Got it?
He returned his attention to Dunk.
Got this covered. I'm hearing you loud and clear.
20 years. I've had it with your bullshit. This hobby of yours.
Totally understand your feelings. I spoke out of turn. New boilers up and running, no problem.
Dunk kept glowering at him. It was hard to say how things were going to go. Finally, giving Michael a last hard shove against the bunker, Dunk backed away. He turned toward Michael's men and nailed them with a hard look. You three should be more careful. Michael withheld his coughing until Dunk was out of sight.
Jesus, Michael.
Rand was staring at him.
Oh, he's just having a bad day. He'll cool off.
You two, back to work. Rand, you're with me. Weir frowned.
You don't want us to go to the stills?
No, I don't. I'll look in on them later. They walked away.
You shouldn't goad him like that, Rand said.
Michael paused to cough again. He felt a little foolish, though on the other hand, the whole thing had been strangely gratifying. It was nice when people were themselves.
Have you seen Greer anywhere? He took a launch up the channel this morning.
So, feeding day. Michael always worried. Amy still tried to kill Greer every time, but the man took it in stride. Except for Rand, who'd been with them from the beginning, none of Michael's men knew about that part of things. Amy, Carter, the Chevron Mariner, the jugs of blood that Greer dutifully delivered every 60 days. Rand glanced around.
How long do you think we have before the virals come back?
He asked quietly. It's got to be close by now. Michael shrugged.
It's not that I'm not grateful. We all are. But people want to be ready.
If they do their damn jobs, we'll be long gone before it happens. Michael hitched his tool bag onto his shoulder.
And for fuck's sake, will somebody please go find Patch? I don't want to wait around all morning.
It was evening when Michael finally emerged from the bowels of the ship. His knees were killing him. He'd done something to his neck, too. He'd never found the leak, either. But he would. He always did. He would find it, and every other leak and rusty rivet and frayed wire in the Bergensfjord's miles of cables and wires and pipes. And soon, in a matter of months, they would charge the batteries and test-fire the engines. And if all went as it should, they'd be ready. Michael liked to imagine that day. The pumps engaging, water pouring into the dock, the retaining wall opening, and the Bergensfjord, all 20,000 tons of her, sliding gracefully from her braces into the sea. For 2 decades, Michael had thought of little else. The trade had been Greer's idea. A stroke of genius, really. They needed money, a lot of it. What did they have to sell? A month after he'd shown Lucius the newspaper from the Bergensfjord, Michael had found himself in the back room of the gambling hall known as Cousin's Place, sitting across a table from Dunk Withers. Michael knew him to be a man of extraordinary temper, lacking all conscience, driven by only the most utilitarian concerns. Michael's life meant nothing to him, because no one's did. But Michael's reputation had preceded him, and he'd done his homework. The gates were about to open. People would be flooding into the townships. The opportunities were many, Michael pointed out. But did the trade possess the capacity to meet a rapidly growing demand? What would Dunk say if Michael told him that he could quadruple his output? That he could also guarantee an uninterrupted flow of ammunition? And furthermore, what if Michael knew about a place where the trade could operate in complete safety, beyond the reach of the military or the domestic authority, but with quick access to Kerrville and the townships? That in sum, he could make Dunk Withers richer than he could imagine. Thus was the Isthmus born. A great deal of time was wasted at the start. Before Michael could so much as tighten a single bolt on the Bergensfjord, he had to win the man's confidence. For 3 years he had overseen the construction of the massive stills that would make Dunk Withers a legend. Michael was not unaware of the costs. How many fistfights would leave a man bloodied and toothless? How many bodies would be dumped into alleyways? How many wives and children would be beaten or even killed, all because of the mental poison he provided? He tried not to think about it. The Bergensfjord was all that mattered. It was a price she demanded, paid in blood. Along the way, he laid the groundwork for his true enterprise. He began with the refinery. Cautious inquiries. Who seemed bored, dissatisfied, restless? Rand Horgan was the first. He and Michael had worked the cookers together for years. Others followed, recruited from every corner. Greer would leave for a few days, then return with a man in a jeep with nothing but a duffel bag and his promise to stay on the isthmus for 5 years, in exchange for wages so outrageous they would set him up for life. The numbers accumulated. Soon they had 54 stout souls with nothing to lose. Michael noticed a pattern. The money was an inducement, but what these men really sought was something intangible. A great many people drifted through their lives without a feeling of purpose. Each day felt indistinguishable from the last, devoid of meaning. When he unveiled the Bergensfjord to each new recruit, Michael could see a change in the man's eyes. Here was something beyond the scope of ordinary days, something from before the time of mankind's diminishment. It was the past Michael was giving these men, and, with it, the future. "We're actually going to fix it?" they always asked. "Not it," Michael corrected. "Her." "And no, we're not going to fix her. We're going to wake her up." It didn't always take. Michael's rule was this. At the 3-year mark, once Michael was certain of a man's loyalty, he took him to an isolated hut, sat him in a chair, and gave him the bad news. Most took it well. A moment of disbelief, a brief period of bargaining with the cosmos, requests for evidence Michael declined to provide, resistance eventually yielding to acceptance, and finally, a melancholy gratitude. They would be among the living, after all. As for those who didn't last 3 years, or failed the test of the hut, well, that was unfortunate. Greer was the one to take care of this. Michael kept his distance. They were surrounded by water, into which a man could quietly vanish. Afterward, his name was never mentioned. It took 2 years to repair the dock, another 2 to pump and refloat the hull, a 5th to back her in. The day they set her hull in the braces, sealed the doors, and drained the water from the dock was the most anxious of Michael's life. The braces would hold, or not. The hull would crack, or it wouldn't. 1,000 things could go wrong, and there would be no second chances. As a layer of daylight appeared between the receding water and the bottom of the hull, his men erupted in cheers. But Michael's emotions were different. He felt not elation, but a sense of fate. Alone, he took the stairs to the bottom of the dock. The cheers had quieted. Everyone was watching him. With water pooling around his ankles, he stepped toward her cautiously, as if approaching some great holy relic. Clear of the water, she had become something new. The sheer size of her, her indomitable bulk, it staggered the mind. The curvature of her hull below the waterline possessed an almost feminine softness. From her bow jutted a bulbous shape, like a nose or the front of a bullet. He moved under her. All her weight was above him now, a mountain suspended over his head. He reached up and placed a hand against her hull. She was cold. A humming sensation met the tips of his fingers. It was as if she were breathing, a living thing. A deep certainty flowed into his veins. Here was his mission. All other possibilities for his life dropped away. Until the day he died, he would have no purpose but this. Except to sail the Nautilus, Michael had not left the Isthmus since. A show of solidarity, politically wise. but in his heart, he knew the real reason. He belonged nowhere else. He walked to the bow to look for Greer. A damp March wind was blowing. The isthmus, part of an old shipyard complex, jutted into the channel a quarter mile south of the channel bridge. 100 yards offshore, the Nautilus lay at anchor. Her hull was still tight, her canvas crisp. The sight made him feel disloyal. He had not sailed her in months. She was the forerunner. If the Bergensfjord was his wife, then the Nautilus was the girl who had taught him to love. He heard the launch before he saw it, churning under the channel bridge in the silvery light. Michael descended to the service dock as Greer guided the boat in. He tossed Michael a line. How did it go? Greer tied off the stern, passed Michael his rifle, and climbed onto the pier. Just past 70, he had aged the way bulls did. 1 minute they'd be huffing and snorting, looking to gore you. The next you'd find them lying in a field, covered in flies. Well, Michael offered, she didn't kill you. That's a plus. Greer didn't answer. Michael sensed that the man was troubled. The visit had not gone well. Lucius, did she say something?
Say, you know how this works.
Actually, I've never really known. He shrugged. It's a feeling I have. She has. Probably it's nothing. Michael decided not to press. There was something else I wanted to bring up with you. I had a little run-in with Dunk today. Greer was coiling rope. You know how he gets. This time tomorrow he'll have forgotten all about it. I don't think he's going to let this one go. It was bad. Greer looked up. It was my fault. I was egging him on.
What happened?
He came down to the engine room. The usual bullshit about the stills. Rand and a couple of guys practically had to pull him off me. Greer's brow furrowed.
There's been too much of this.
I know. He's getting to be a problem. Michael paused, then said, It may be time. Greer was silent, taking this in.
We've talked about it.
Greer thought for a moment, then nodded.
Under the circumstances, you may be right.
They went over the names, who they could count on, who they couldn't, who was somewhere in between and would have to be carefully handled.
You should lie low for now, Greer said. Rand and I will make the arrangements.
If you think that's best. The spotlights had come on, drenching the dock with light. Michael would be working most of the night.
Just get that ship ready, said Greer.
Sarah glanced up from her desk. Jenny was standing in the doorway.
Sarah, you need to see something.
Sarah followed her downstairs to the wards. Jenny pulled back the curtain to show her.
The DS found him in an alley.
It took Sarah a moment to recognize her own son-in-law. His face had been beaten to a pulp. Both of his arms were in casts. They moved back outside.
Jenny said, I only just saw the chart and realized who it was.
Where's Kate?
She's on the evening shift.
It was nearly 4 o'clock. Kate would be walking in the door any second.
Head her off. What do you want me to say?
Sarah took a moment to think.
Send her to the orphanage. Aren't they due for a visit?
I don't know.
Figure it out. Go.
Sarah entered the ward. As she approached, Bill looked up with the eyes of a man who knew his day was about to get worse.
Okay. What happened? She asked.
He turned his face away.
I'm disappointed in you, Bill.
He spoke through split lips.
I kind of figured.
How much do you owe them?
He told her. Sarah dropped into a chair by the bed.
How could you be so goddamn stupid?
It wasn't like I planned this.
You know they'll kill you. Probably I should just let them.
He surprised her by starting to cry.
Cripes, don't do that, she said.
I can't help it.
Snot was running from his thickened nose.
I love Kate. I love the girls. I'm really, really sorry.
Sorry doesn't help. How much time have they given you to come up with the money?
I can earn it all back. Just stake me for one night. I won't need much. Just enough to get started.
Does Kate fall for stuff like this?
She doesn't have to know.
It was a rhetorical question, Bill. How much time?
The usual. 3 days.
What's usual about it?
On second thought, don't tell me.
She got to her feet.
You can't tell Hollis. He'll kill me.
He might.
I'm sorry, Sarah. I screwed up, I know that.
Jenny appeared, a little breathless.
Okay, looks like she bought it.
Sarah glanced at her watch.
That gives you about an hour, Bill, before your wife shows up. I suggest you come clean and beg for mercy.
The man looked terrified.
What are you going to do?
Nothing you deserve.
27. Caleb was building a chicken coop when he saw a figure walking up the dusty road. It was late in the afternoon. Pim and Theo were resting in the house.
Saw your smoke. The man who stood before him had a pleasant, weathered face and a thick, woolly beard. He was wearing a wide straw hat and suspenders. Since we're going to be neighbors, thought I'd come by to say hello. Phil Tatum's the name.
Caleb Jackson.
They shook. We're just on the other side of that ridge. Been there a bit before most folks. There's me and my wife, Dorian. We got a grown boy just started his own place up toward Bandera.
Did you say Jackson?
That's right. He's my father.
I'll be damned. What are you doing way out here?
Same as everyone, I guess. Making do. Caleb removed his gloves. Come in and meet my family. Pim was sitting in a chair by the cold hearth with Theo on her lap, showing him a picture book. Pim, Caleb said, signing along, this is our neighbor, Mr. Tatum.
How do you do, Mrs. Jackson?
He was holding his hat against his chest. Please, don't get up on my account.
I'm very pleased to meet you.
Caleb realized his error. I should have explained. My wife is deaf. She says she's pleased to meet you. The man nodded evenly. Got a cousin like that. Passed a while back. She learned to read lips a little, but the poor thing just lived in her own world. He raised his voice, the way a lot of people did.
That's a fine-looking boy you have, Mrs. Jackson.
What's he saying?
You're beautiful, and he wants to go to bed with you. He turned to their guest, who was still fingering the brim of his hat. She says thank you, Mr. Tatum.
Don't be rude. Ask him if he wants something to drink.
Caleb repeated the question.
I have to be home before supper, but I reckon I could sit for a bit. Thank you.
Pim filled the pitcher with water, added slices of lemon and placed it on the table where the two men sat. They talked about little things, the weather, other homesteads in the area, where Caleb should get his livestock and at what price. Pim had gone off with Theo. She liked to take him down to the river, where the two of them would just sit quietly. It became clear to Caleb that the man and his wife were a little lonely. Their son had gone off with a woman he'd met at a dance in Hunt, barely saying goodbye.
Couldn't help notice your wife is expecting, Tatum said.
They had finished the water. Now they were just talking. Yes, she's due in September.
There's a dock in Mystic when the time comes.
He gave Caleb the information.
That's very kind.
Thank you. Caleb sensed the presence of a sad history in the man's offer. The Tatums had had another child, perhaps more than one, who had failed to survive. This was all far in the past, but not really.
Much obliged to you both, Tatum said at the door. It's nice to have some young people around.
That night, Caleb replayed the conversation for Pim. She was bathing Theo in the sink. He had fussed at the start, but now seemed to be enjoying himself, batting the water around with his fists.
I should call on his wife, Pim signed.
Do you want me to go with you? He meant to translate for her. She looked at him like he had lost his mind.
Don't be ridiculous.
This conversation stayed with him for several days. Somehow, in all his planning, Caleb had failed to consider that they would need other people in their lives. Some of this was the fact that with Pim he shared a private richness that made other relationships seem trivial. Also, he was not innately social. He preferred his own thoughts to most human interaction. It was true as well that Pim's world was more limited than most people's. Beyond her family, it was confined to a small group of those who, if they could not sign, were able to intuit her meanings. She was often alone, which did not seem to trouble her, and she filled much of this time by writing. Caleb had peeked at her journals a few times over the years, unable to resist this small crime. Like her letters, her entries were wonderfully written. While they sometimes expressed doubts or concern over various matters, generally they communicated an optimistic view of life. They also contained a number of sketches, though he had never seen her draw. Most depicted familiar scenes. There were a great many drawings of birds and animals, as well as the faces of people she knew, although none of him. He wondered why she had never let him see them, why she had drawn them in secret. The best ones were the seascapes. Remarkable, because Pim had never seen the ocean. Still, she would want friends. 2 days after Phil had stopped by, Pim asked Caleb if he would mind looking after Theo for a few hours. She wanted to visit the Tatums and planned to bring a Johnny cake. Caleb spent the afternoon working in the garden while Theo napped in a basket. He began to worry as the day drew to a close. But just before dark, Pim returned in high spirits. When Caleb asked her how they had been able to carry on a conversation for close to 5 hours, Pim smiled. It doesn't matter with women, she sighed. We always understand each other just fine. The next morning, Caleb took the buckboard into town for supplies and to reshoe one of the horses, the big black gelding they called Handsome. Pim had also written a letter to Kate and asked him to post it. Besides these errands, he wanted to establish contact with more people from the area. He could ask the men he met about their wives, with the hope of expanding Pim's circle, so that she would not feel lonely. The town was not encouraging. Just a few weeks had passed since he and Pim had passed through on their way to the farmstead. At the time, there had been people about, but now the place seemed lifeless. The town office was closed, as was the farrier. But he had better luck at the mercantile. The owner was a widower named George Pettibrew. Like many men on the frontier, he had a taciturn manner, slow to warm up, and Caleb had never managed to learn much about him. George followed him as he moved through the cluttered space, placing his order. A sack of flour, beet sugar, a length of heavy chain, sewing thread, 30 yards of chicken wire, a sack of nails, lard, cornmeal, salt, oil for the lanterns, and 50 pounds of feed. I'd also like to buy some ammo, Caleb said, as George was tallying the bill at the counter. 30-06. The man made a certain expression. You and everybody else. He continued jotting figures with a stub of pencil. I can give you 6. How many in a box? Not boxes. Rounds. It seemed like a joke. That's all? Since when? George poked his thumb over his shoulder. Tacked to the wall behind the counter was a sign. $100 bounty. Mountain lion. Present carcass at Hunt Township office to collect. Folks cleaned me out. Not that I had much to begin with. Ammo's scarce these days. I'll give 'em to you for a buck apiece.
That's ridiculous.
George shrugged. Business was business. It was all the same to him. Caleb wanted to tell him to stick it. But on the other hand, a mountain lion was nothing to mess with. He rolled off the bills.
Think of it as an investment, George said, depositing the money in his lockbox. You bag that cat. This won't seem so much, will it? Everything went into the wagon. Caleb surveyed the empty street. It really was awfully damn quiet for the middle of the day. He found it a little unnerving, though mostly he felt disappointed that he would return with so little to show for his visit. He was about to drive out of town when he remembered the doctor Tatum had told him about. It would be good to introduce himself. The doctor's name was Ilaqua. According to Tatum, he had once worked at the hospital in Kerrville and retired to the townships. There weren't many houses, and the doctor's was easy to find. A small frame structure, painted a cheerful yellow, with a sign that read, Brian Ilaqua, M.D., hanging off the porch. A pickup truck with rusted fenders was parked in the yard. Caleb tied up the horses and knocked. A single eye peeked through the curtain on the door's window.
What do you want?
The voice was loud, almost hostile.
Are you Dr. Ilaqua? Who's asking?
Caleb regretted coming. There was obviously something wrong with the man. He thought he might be drunk.
My name is Caleb Jackson. Phil Tatum is my neighbor. He said you were the doctor in town.
Are you sick?
I just wanted to say hello. We're new out here. My wife is expecting.
It's all right. I can come back later.
But as Caleb stepped off the porch, the door opened.
Jackson?
That's right. The doctor had the look of a derelict, thick at the waist, with a wild mane of snow-white hair and a beard to match.
You might as well come in.
His wife, a nervous woman in a shapeless house dress, served them some kind of bad-tasting tea in the parlor. No explanation was offered for Ilaqua's curt behavior at the door. Maybe that was just how things were done out here, Caleb thought.
How far along is your wife? Ilaqua asked, after they'd gotten past the formalities.
He had, Caleb noted, put a little something in his tea from a pocket flask.
About 4 months.
Caleb saw an opening. My mother-in-law is Sarah Wilson. Maybe you know her.
Know her? I trained her. I thought her daughter worked at the hospital, though.
That's Kate. My wife is Pim.
He thought for a moment.
I don't remember a Pim.
Oh, the mute.
He shook his head sadly.
The poor thing. Nice of you to marry her.
Caleb had heard statements like this before. I'm sure she thinks it's the other way around.
On the other hand, who wouldn't want a wife who couldn't talk? I can barely put two thoughts together around here.
Caleb just looked at him.
Well, Ilaqua said and cleared his throat. I can pay a call if she'd like, just to see how things are going.
At the door, Caleb remembered Pim's letter. He asked Ilaqua if he would mind posting it for him when the office opened.
I can try. Those people are never there.
I was wondering about that, Caleb said. The town seems kind of empty.
I didn't notice.
He frowned doubtfully.
Could be the mountain lion, I guess. That happens out here.
Has anyone been attacked?
Not that I've heard. Just livestock. With a bounty, a lot of folks are out looking. Stupid, if you ask me. Those things are nasty.
Caleb rode out of town. At least he'd tried to post the letter. As for Ilaqua, he seriously doubted Pim would want anything to do with the man. The mountain lion didn't concern him unduly. It was simply the price one paid for life on the frontier. Still, he would tell Pim not to take Theo to the river for a while. The two of them should stay near the house until the matter was resolved. They ate their supper and went to bed. Rain was falling, making a peaceful pattering on the roof. In the middle of the night, Caleb awoke to a sharp cry. For a terrifying second, he thought something had happened to Theo. But then the sound came again, from outside. It was fear he was hearing. Fear and mortal pain. An animal was dying. In the morning, he searched the brush behind the house. He came to an area of broken branches.
Tufts of short, stiff hair, tacky with blood, were spread over the ground. He thought it might have been a raccoon. He scanned the area for tracks, but the rain had washed them away. The next day he walked over the ridge to the Tatums. Their operation was much larger than his own, with a good-sized barn and a house with a standing seam metal roof. Boxes of blue bonnets hung beneath the front windows. Dorian Tatum greeted him at the door, a plump-cheeked woman with gray hair in a bun. She directed him to the far edge of the property, where her husband was clearing brush.
A mountain lion, you say?
Phil removed his hat to mop his brow in the heat.
That's the word in town. We've had 'em before. Long gone by now, I'd guess. They're restless sons of bitches.
I thought so, too. Probably it's nothing.
I'll keep a lookout, though. Thank your wife for the Johnny cake, won't you? Dory really enjoyed her visit. Those two were writing messages to each other for hours.
Caleb made to leave, then stopped. What's it usually like in town? Tatum was drinking from a canteen.
What you mean?
Well, it was pretty quiet. It seemed odd in the middle of the day. Now that he'd said it, he felt a little silly. The town office was shut. The farrier, too.
I was hoping to get one of the horses reshod.
Folks are usually around.
Maybe Juno's taken sick.
Juno Brand was the farrier. Maybe that's it. Phil smiled through his beard.
Go round in a day or two. I bet you'll find him. But you get hard up for something, you let us know.
Caleb had decided not to tell Pim about what he'd found in the woods. There seemed no good reason to alarm her, and a dead raccoon meant nothing. But that night, as they were cleaning up the dishes, he repeated his request that she and Theo stay close to the house.
You worry too much, she sighed.
Sorry.
Don't be.
She turned at the sink to surprise him with a lingering kiss.
It's one of the reasons I love you.
He wagged his eyebrows cornily.
Does this mean what I think it does?
Let me get Theo down first.
But there was no need. The boy was already asleep. 28. She began the night, as she began all nights, atop the partially constructed office tower at the corner of 43rd and 5th Avenue. The air was blustery, with a hint of warmth. Stars bedecked the heavens, thick as dust. The shapes of great buildings crenellated the sky in silhouettes of perfect blackness. The Empire State, Rockefeller Center, the magnificent Chrysler Building, Fanning's favorite, soaring above everything around it with its graceful Art Deco crown. The hours after midnight were the ones Alicia liked best. The quiet was richer somehow, the air purer. She felt closer to the core of things, the world's rich chroma of sound and scent and texture. The night flowed through her, a coursing in the blood. She breathed it in and out. A darkness indomitable. Supreme. She crossed the roof to the construction crane and began to climb. Attached to the exposed girders of the building's upper floors, it soared another 100 feet above the roof. There were stairs, but Alicia never bothered, stairs being a thing of the past, a quaint feature of a life she barely recalled. The boom, hundreds of feet long, was positioned parallel with the building's west face. She made her way down the catwalk to the boom's tip, from which a long, hooked chain dangled in the darkness. Alicia winched it up, released the brake, and drew the hook backward along the boom. Where the boom met the mast was a small platform. She laid the hook there, returned to the tip, and reset the chain's brake. Then, back to the platform. A keen anticipation filled her, like a hunger about to be slaked. Standing erect, head held high, she gripped the hook in her fists and stepped off. She plunged down and away. The trick was to release the hook at just the right moment, when her speed and upward momentum existed in perfect balance. This would occur roughly two-thirds up the back side of the hook's arc. She swung through the bottom, still accelerating. Her body, her senses, her thoughts, all were attuned, at one with speed and space. She released the hook, her body inverted. She tucked her knees to her chest. Three aerial rolls, and she uncoiled. The flat-topped roof across the street. That was the target. It rose in greeting. Welcome, Alicia. Touchdown. Her powers had expanded. It was as if, in the presence of her creator, some powerful mechanism within her had been fully unleashed. The aerial spaces of the city were trivial. She could vault vast distances, alight on the narrowest ledges, cling to the tiniest cracks. Gravity was a toy to her. She ranged above Manhattan like a bird. In the glass faces of skyscrapers, her reflected image dove and darted, plunged and swooped. She found herself, sometime later, above Third Avenue, near the demarcation between land and sea. A few blocks south of Astor Place, the encroaching waters began, bubbling up from the island's flooded underworld. She descended, ping-ponging between buildings to the street. Broken shells lay everywhere among the dried husks of ocean weeds, swept inward by storm surges. She knelt and pressed her ear to the pavement. They were definitely moving. The grate pulled away easily. She dropped into the tunnel, lit her torch, and began to walk south. A ribbon of dark water sloshed at her feet. Fanning's many had been eating. Their droppings were everywhere, rank, ureic, as were the skeletal remains of their feeding. Mice, rats, the small creatures of the city's clammy substratum. Some of the droppings were fresh, a few days old at the most. She passed through the Astor Place station. Now she could feel it. The sea. The great bulge of it, always pressing, seeking to enlarge its domain, to drown the world with its cold blue weight. Her heart had quickened. The hairs stood up along her arms. It's only water, she told herself. Only water. The bulkhead appeared. A thin spray of water, almost a mist, shot from its edges. She stepped toward it. A moment's hesitation. Then she extended a hand to touch its frigid face. On the other side, untold tons of pressure lay in stasis, stalemated for a century by the weight of the door. Fanning had explained the history. The entire Manhattan subway system lay below sea level. It had been a disaster waiting to happen. After Hurricane Wilma had flooded the tunnels, the city fathers had constructed a series of heavy doors to hold the water in check. In the throes of the epidemic, when the electricity had failed, a fail-safe mechanism had sealed them. There they had rested for over a century, holding the encroaching ocean at bay.
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
She heard a skittering behind her. She spun, raising her torch. At the edge of the darkness, a pair of orange eyes flared. A large male, but skinny, the bumps of his ribs showing. He squatted frog-like between the tracks, a rat gripped in his mouth with the very tips of his teeth. The rat squirmed and squeaked, its bald tail whipping.
What are you looking at? Alicia said. Get out of here!
The jaws clamped shut, an arcing pop of blood and a sucking sound, and the viral spat the empty bag of bones and fur to the ground. Alicia's stomach tumbled, not with nausea, but hunger. She hadn't eaten for a week. The viral extended its claws, petting the air like a cat. It cocked his head. What sort of being is this?
Go on! She waved the torch like a pike. Shoo! Scat!
A last look, almost fond,
It darted away. Fanning had already prepared for daybreak.